I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Options are running out for the parents of Terry Schiavo. A Florida judge has rejected a call by Governor Jeb Bush to have custody of Schiavo moved to the state. And earlier today, the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, rejected an appeal from Schiavo's parents to reinsert Schiavo's feeding tube. That tube was removed last Friday, and doctors said then that the 41-year-old Florida woman would die within a week or two. Leslie Clark is a reporter for the Miami Herald. She's been covering this case. She joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Leslie, let's start with the state decision. Jeb Bush had asked that the state be allowed to take Terry Schiavo into protective custody. It sounds as if that's not going to happen.
Hey, good afternoon. Yeah, it had been sort of a last-minute, last-ditch appeal by the governor yesterday afternoon, who came up with a new neurologist, he said, who had viewed Terry Schiavo and disagreed with the diagnosis that the other doctors had come up with.
This neurologist is somewhat controversial. He's a longtime doctor, but he only began studying, I believe, in 2000 to become one of a handful of Christian bioethicists. Did he examine Terry Schiavo?
He did not examine Terry Schiavo. He went into her hospice room and apparently viewed her for 90 minutes or so, and he said that he also watched some of the videotape that has been played of her.
So the court has rejected that request that his opinion guide the court's hand. Tell us also about the Supreme Court decision. What did the U.S. Supreme Court say in their decision?
Not much. Their decision came down quite rapidly. The Schindlers filed last night at about 11 o'clock, and then Michael Schiavo answered early this morning. The Supreme Court, about 10 o'clock or so, came out with a very terse statement that simply says that the application for the stay is denied.
We understand people like Ronald Crawford with the University of Minnesota. He's a neurologist who was among those who made a previous diagnosis of Terry Schiavo, said there isn't a reputable, credible neurologist in the world who won't find her in a persistent vegetative state. Given that, given these court rulings, what happens now?
Well, what happens now is that the family is likely to make another appeal, another pitch to the governor to try to intervene in the case.
What was the governor planning? Were they planning to physically, when they said take her into protective custody, how would that have worked? Do we know?
They would have put her under the auspices of the state's Department of Children and Families, which is authorized to take care of people when there's been allegations of harm, and they would have transferred to our hospital and had the feeding tube reinserted.
And remind us, how many days has it been that Terry Schiavo has been off the feeding tube, and what's the sense of her condition?
It's been 6 days. Tomorrow will be a week since she was removed from the feeding tube, and reports are from her parents' attorneys that she's, you know, the organs are beginning to shut down and that she shows signs of being dehydrated.
Yeah. Many of our listeners have asked, why haven't we seen more recent pictures, videotape of her? The videotape that is airing constantly is old. And I understand there was talk at one time among Republicans of placing a video or audio recorder in Schiavo's hospice room so lawmakers could better assess her condition. Is there any sense of that happening? Is there any sense that Congress can do any more intervention?
Congress seems to really have sort of stepped back from the issue. By Wednesday, they were sort of saying that, you know, we've sort of done all we could on the issue. So I don't really think that it doesn't seem, from what I'm hearing, that they are all that interested in getting involved again. The issue of why there hasn't been more updated videotapes or pictures of her, I think, is a matter between her husband and her parents that I don't think he's allowed. As her guardian, I don't think he's allowed, you know, videotaping to go on. I'm not sure, but that's the only thing that I could surmise that's happened.
Well, for now, it seems that most avenues are closed to Terry Schiavo's parents. Leslie Clark, a reporter for the Miami Herald, who has been covering this story. Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thank you.
Well, a new CBS poll shows that 82% of the respondents want the president and Congress to stay out of the Terry Schiavo case. The poll also shows that 74% of people think Congress is getting involved because of political motives, not because they care about Terry Schiavo. This comes as House Majority Leader Tom DeLay comes under fire for statements he made about the Terry Schiavo case at a meeting of the Conservative Family Research Council last week.
One thing that God has brought to us is Terry Schiavo, to elevate the visibility of what's going on in America.
Those remarks were secretly recorded at the Family Research Council's Washington briefing at the Willard Hotel in Washington, D.C. last week. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist also addressed attendees via the telephone. The recording of DeLay was obtained by the left-leaning Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and the organization's executive director, Barry Lynn, joins us on the line. And Mr. Lynn, first of all, how did you get this recording?
We were given this recording by someone who was in attendance at the Family Research Council's annual meeting. And, of course, we were shocked by the comments that followed those excerpts that you just indicated, because here was Tom DeLay not only talking about the Terry Schiavo case and speaking to his religious right base, but then saying that the Terry Schiavo matter was actually an example of, quote, of attacks against the conservative movement, against me and against many others, suggesting that he was going to get the religious rights help, he hoped, on the attacks, so-called attacks on him.
We have Tom DeLay's comments. Others have also said it seems to compare the ethics allegations against him to the plight of Terry Schiavo. Let's listen.
This is exactly the issue that's going on in America, that of attacks against the conservative movement, against me and against many others. The point is the other side has figured out how to win and defeat the conservative movement. And that is to go after people personally, charge them with frivolous charges.
Barry Lynn, what are your concerns about Tom DeLay's comments?
Previously, Tom DeLay and the religious right always talked about being pro-family, about keeping husbands and wives together. That's, of course, their only definition of marriage. But then when it's inconvenient for them, because they see, Mr. Schiavo as not representing the so-called culture of life, they simply change their position and all of a sudden decide that issues that used to be in state courts are now to be in federal courts, that issues that were important to be resolved within families are now literally to be decided by the United States Supreme Court if they ultimately get their way. So there are just many layers of hypocrisy here.
This, as we said, was a secretly recorded conversation that Tom DeLay had with a gathering of his supporters. Do you think that's fair?
I think it's fair when you offer to have a meeting. People pay to go to that meeting. That it's not unexpected that people are going to tape what's going on at that meeting and listen to these public addresses or take them to someone else. It just happens that someone took them to us. Back in 2001, we had obtained a tape of Mr. DeLay speaking to some meeting in Texas where he suggested that parents should not send their children to Baylor or Texas A&M anymore because they were teaching evolution. He was not happy when that was revealed either, and neither were a lot of prominent alumni of those institutions.
Barry Lynn is Executive Director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Barry, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And this note, we asked Congressman DeLay's office for a comment and did not get a response. Well, will the Republican Party lawmakers led by Tom DeLay suffer for their strong role in passage of a law allowing federal courts to intervene in the Schiavo case? A handful of Republicans think so. Joining us on the line is Republican Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut. He was one of five Republicans to vote against the legislation. And Congressman Shays, your take on the Schiavo case, was Congress correct to intervene?
Well, I think Congress made a very grievous mistake intervening. My own party, my own Republican Party, believes in states' rights and local decision-making unless they don't like the decision sometimes of local and state governments, and then we jump in. But we jumped in a way that I think will be very difficult to sort out. What we're saying basically is that any family that has a dispute can now petition the federal court and have us step in on what has clearly always been a state issue.
So you disagree on the issue of states' rights, but second question, do you feel this has also perhaps backfired for your party? New polls out show that Americans overwhelmingly disagree with the intervention, and also Congress expected the federal courts to call for a complete review. That hasn't happened.
Well, I mean, I can just tell you, neighbors and friends are very concerned that if they have made a decision and they've told families and friends what that decision is, that the court then determines that that is exactly what that individual wants, and then a leader in my party or my party in general or any party can step in and say, we're going to publicize this case and we're going to inject our own view.
But Congressman, you are one of only five Republican congressmen voting against intervention. What does this mean for the Republican Party?
Well, I think it means that this Republican Party is getting closer and closer to wanting to inject its own personal and religious views on all Americans, even if all Americans don't agree. And ultimately, it is going to backfire. I think part of this was to appeal to a base within the Republican Party, an important base, a very religious, heartfelt base of people who ultimately are really dominating the view of the Republican Party. This is the party of Lincoln, and I'm not sure. This is also the party of former Senator Goldwater, who was very conservative, but I don't think he would feel comfortable with the decisions that are being made by many in my party.
In fact, you've been quoted as saying the GOP is becoming the party of theocracy. And your thoughts on the latest political wrinkle in this story, the secret tape recording of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay speaking to a gathering of conservatives and saying that Terry Schiavo was sent by God to help in the Republican political fight on right-to-life issues.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, it's one that I don't think God did that. I think this is a young woman who had a terrible tragedy, and I think that her views were made clear to her husband, and if you think her husband now is conflicted, her views were made clear to her friends that Terry would not want this to be happening, and it is happening, and I think it's very intrusive, and I think it's very, very unfortunate.
Republican Congressman Christopher Shays of Connecticut. Well, just ahead, we'll hear from a Republican congressman who did vote to force federal review of the Terry Schiavo case, and Arizona's Trent Franks says he believes in his heart in erring on the side of life. We'll hear from him in a minute. But first, we want to hear from you. We've had a lot of email response to this developing story. For example, Giovanni Yulia of Charlotte, North Carolina writes, feeding tubes are removed from patients all the time for various reasons. People in Terry's condition are not alive. Their bodies are artificially sustained, but the soul and the consciousness are gone. No one, especially Congress and the President, has any right to meddle with a life or death decision that is solely the burden and right of the patient and their spouse or family. But Eileen McGuire of Philadelphia had this thought, I believe there is a difference between artificially prolonging life via a respirator and assisting life via a feeding tube. In the video I've seen, Ms. Schiavo is conscious and smiling. While the quality of life issues rage, she's alive. She's breathing and not being artificially kept alive. I understand that Michael Schiavo wants to start a new life with his girlfriend and their two children, but removing Terry's feeding tube is a prolonged and savage way to do this. And as we mentioned, the state court has turned down Governor Jeb Bush's request to reinsert that feeding tube. And the U.S. Supreme Court has declined to take the case. Well, we want to hear from you. Tell us what you think about the Terry Schiavo case. Email us at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. And we'll read some of your thoughts later in the program. Stay there. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, continuing our conversation on the political fallout from the case of Terry Schiavo. As we said, the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected her parents' last-ditch attempt to reinsert her feeding tube through the U.S. Supreme Court. A judge in Florida has rejected the state of Florida's bid to gain custody of Terry Schiavo. In Washington, lawmakers are wondering how this will play out in congressional elections next year while others wait in a vigil around Terry Schiavo. Well, joining us on the line is Republican Congressman Trent Franks of Arizona. Congressman Franks, your reaction, first of all, to the Supreme Court's decision today.
Well, of course, I'm terribly disappointed, but I have to suggest to you that I'm not shocked. The courts ultimately intervened in the first place on this case. You know, sometimes I'm hearing that people are upset with Congress for intervening, but they forget that it was the courts who intervened to take the tube that fed Terry Schiavo so that she couldn't survive. And the Congress only intervened when the courts failed to do their job to protect Terry Schiavo's constitutional rights. And I'm afraid that we've been at a great constitutional divide in this country for a long time, and the courts seem almost more committed to a death ethic than they do a judicial ethic.
Well, and you have said that before, but you're talking about judicial activism, but this Supreme Court is largely conservative. Judge Rehnquist is at the top of it. I mean, are you saying that the conservatives are letting you down?
This Supreme Court upheld partial birth abortion as a constitutional right. This is not a surprise that they would starve one woman to death.
Well, Congressman, how do you feel about the fact that in a recent CBS survey, 82% of those surveyed said President Bush and Congress should stay out of the Terri Schiavo case. 74% said Congress was motivated by political considerations, not concern for Ms. Schiavo.
Well, you know, they overlooked the fact that our primary purpose in government is to protect the lives and the constitutional rights of those that we seek to be in governance of. And I'm just astonished that we've gone so far as to saying that somehow this country is committed to allowing an innocent woman to starve and thirst to death in front of her family. And that is a dark line that if we step over, we will scar the American soul somewhat.
Again, this is a debate we're not going to resolve here because most experts are telling us that it's a very compassionate, gentle death. But putting that aside for a second, how do you respond to members of your party and bringing up another issue here? We just heard from Connecticut Congressman Christopher Shays. Republican John Warner of Virginia also joins him in saying that the GOP is abandoning its belief in federalism, that this is an issue of states' rights, and you're banning that issue to take up the banner for one family and the Right to Life movement.
Well, the reality is that the Republican Party was born out of a commitment in the hearts of people to protect those in society that no one else wanted to protect. So I've got to tell you, I think that those who are trying to protect the innocent here are not only in the center point of the Republican Party, but they can look back when their time comes to die and say, I did my best to uphold human dignity while I lived.
What do you think will happen from here, and will there be some retribution on those courts? We have a battle coming up over confirming judges.
Well, as far as the courts go, I am convinced that unless we somehow, as a people, rein in our courts, we will lose this, the greatest republic in the history of humanity.
What are your constituents telling you?
We have division among the constituents, but you know, I told my constituents when I ran that I would go and do what I thought was truly right. They knew my philosophy in the first place, and my constituents have reelected me in overwhelming numbers, especially when it comes to running against those who hold an opposing philosophy on an issue like this.
Republican Congressman Trent Franks of Arizona speaking to us on the run, and we appreciate it. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
And we now turn to John Harwood, national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. Hi, John. Hello, John.
I'm here.
Yeah, and you know, we want to turn to you for some more political analysis, but I'm also mindful of the fact that, as we've been reporting, the parents of Terri Schiavo have run out of just about every political avenue. There's maybe one left. And so we know that people are conscious of that as well as we speak. And your thoughts, John Harwood, there's been a lot of accusations that many of the lawmakers are acting for political gain. It sounds like people like Trent Franks are speaking from the heart. Your sense of how this issue is being pulled by politicians?
I think many lawmakers like Trent Franks, who you just heard from, are in fact sincere, speaking from the heart, doing what they think is right. Their problem at this point is that the courts are not vindicating their position, and the American people are not vindicating their position. If you look at all the polls, they show that Americans who can relate to these situations because so many of them have experienced them in their lives themselves, don't think that Congress ought to be involved. So it is there is reason to think that there are political benefits in part for some people who are championing the cause of Terri Schiavo because of the intensity of their base within the Republican Party. But the longer this plays out, I think the more risk there is for Republicans of some sort of political backlash.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, do you think there's going to be some payback? We spoke to Trent about the President Bush's picks for judges. They go in front of Congress for confirmation. Is that going to be the brawl that some predict?
It is going to be a brawl, and it's possible that this case may complicate the ability of President Bush and the Republican Party to get the judges that they want. The sight of Congress, the White House, intervening in this case and doing so against the majority sentiment in the country may help Democrats dramatize their argument that Republicans are pursuing appointments to the court who are out of the mainstream of the American population. Now, that certainly is a contentious argument in Washington, and there are two sides to that question, but Democrats may get some benefit out of this case.
And John Harwood is national political editor of the Wall Street Journal. John, in 10 seconds, will it wound the Republican Party? Will this issue further wound the Republican Party than, you know, some people say it already has?
I think it's a potential speed bump for them, probably not long-lasting. By the time the 2006 elections roll around, this case will be in the rearview mirror.
John, thank you.
You bet.
And by the way, earlier I referred to Congressman Franks as Trent. I should never have done that. Congressman Trent Franks also spoke to us earlier. Well, we want to hear from you as well. Remember, send us your thoughts, here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. We'll read some of your responses later in the program. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When the Cleveland Cavaliers fired head coach Paul Silas on Monday, they were following a statistical trend in the NBA. Despite the league's reputation for colorblind hiring of coaches and executives, research by the New York Times has discovered that black coaches in the NBA are fired more quickly than their white counterparts. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, spoke to David Leonhardt, who penned the article in Tuesday's Times, and asked him to sum up his research.
When we looked at every coaching tenure over the last 10 years, we found that black coaches had significantly shorter tenures on average than white coaches. And once we found that, we tried to explain it in all sorts of ways. We thought, well, maybe it's that black coaches have coached worse teams. Maybe it's that black coaches tend to be former players, and former players don't last as long as people who've come up through the coaching ranks. But none of those things explained it. Winning black coaches have shorter tenures on average than winning white coaches. Losing black coaches have shorter tenures than losing white coaches. Rookie black coaches have shorter tenures than rookie white coaches. In any category, you see this difference.
NBA Commissioner David Stern has characterized the numbers that your study produced as, quote, a coincidence. Is there really a big difference between 2.4 years, which is the average tenure of the white coach, and 1.6 years for the black coach?
There is a big difference between those two. It's 50%, first of all, 1.6 and 2.4. But averages are often difficult for people to understand. And I think this is probably an easier way to think about it. Over the last 15 seasons, there have been 16 different tenures that have lasted at least 5 years. So 16 different coaches have lasted at least 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 16, only one of them is black. And there are all sorts of little patterns like that that are underneath the average. The thing to remember about the average is that tenures have gotten quite short. So a difference of a little under a season, you don't want to overstate it. It's not the biggest thing in the world, but it's pretty significant.
I'm curious about another variable that might have come up in this study, and that is, it's such a good old boys club, any pro sports operation. If coach gets fired one place, he gets hired somewhere else. Is that less true of black coaches and assistant coaches than of white coaches and assistant coaches?
That's really interesting, because when we started looking at this, we didn't expect to find what we did. But once we found it, we then said, oh, I bet all these other things will be true, including that. And it's not really true. Doc Rivers, obviously in Boston now, coming from Orlando. Lenny Wilkins, who's had any number of jobs, New York, Toronto, Cleveland, Atlanta. Bernie Bickerstaff is now in Charlotte with the expansion team. He had been in Seattle. Paul Silas, who was just fired previously, had been in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So the carousel seems to move for both white and black coaches.
I think maybe the significant point here is that some number of black coaches and former coaches with whom you spoke feel as if they don't get the same opportunity to succeed as a white coach gets, and your numbers do seem to demonstrate that, right?
That's absolutely right. If these were just numbers in a vacuum, they would be far less interesting. What makes them more interesting is that when I talk to any number of coaches about them, they would interrupt me with some version of, yeah, I don't know your numbers, but...
This did not surprise them.
This did not surprise many of them. Mm. Not all, but certainly far and away the majority. And one thing they really emphasized, and is important to include in any discussion of this, is that the NBA is far and away the league with the most diverse group of coaches and executives. It's not even close. They've been doing it the longest. They have the most number of minority coaches. Every single one of the 30 NBA teams has had a black head coach at some point or other. In the NFL, there are only 10 head coaches in the entire history of the league. And the coaches all emphasized that. They said, though, that it's naive to think that problems that affect an entire society would somehow stop at the door of the NBA, and that these issues of stereotypes and subconscious images based on race are a big part of our entire society.
You've spoken of some of the other sports besides pro basketball, and you do include in your article a mention of a Sports Illustrated survey of Major League Baseball players and their perception of fellow players. What was the significance of that research?
That survey I just thought was amazing. Sports Illustrated a number of years ago polled Major League Baseball players and said, who do you consider to be the players who get the best results out of the least talent? And who do you consider to be the players who get the least results out of the most talent? All five of the players named who supposedly got the most out of the least were white. The top four players who got the least out of the most were black. And then there was a tie for fifth place between one white player and one black player. And that was consistent with another thing that the coaches told us, which is that there are stereotypes in sports with which we're all familiar. The white athlete as the gritty, smart, hardworking gym rat, and the black athlete as prodigal talent who exists with this almost otherworldly skill. And if you think about those stereotypes, which one of those two would you want to coach your team? You would want the hardworking guy, the guy who'd had to work to achieve what he did, the guy who put in the extra hours and who'd thought about how he succeeded. Doc Rivers, who said to us that he actually does not think black coaches are any longer at a disadvantage, still said that he can read a scouting report and guess whether the player is white or black based on the adjectives used to describe him. Rivers also said that he thought there was a real missed opportunity with Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, that he actually thought Bird was the more talented, naturally talented of the two, and Magic was more of the savvy player, but that because of our stereotypes that went along with their race, we weren't quite able to see that.
According to your article, most people seem to think that the NBA coaching situation has improved. Assuming that's true, what should the league be doing now besides staying the course?
I think clearly things are improving. It just seems to me that for all the progress the NBA has made, and again, they not only have more minorities in positions of management than other sports, they probably have more minorities in positions of management than the employers of almost any of your readers, listeners. But to sort of not use that as a crutch to say, well, we're doing better than almost everybody else, therefore, we must not have any problems. It strikes me that being willing to think broadly about these sorts of problems is usually the way that they continue to improve. And the NBA, over the years, has certainly shown a willingness to think broadly about these sorts of issues.
David Leonhardt's article on black coaches in the NBA appeared in Tuesday's edition of the New York Times. He spoke with Onlia Games, Bill Littlefield. Well, still to come, we'll read your thoughts on the Terry Schiavo case, plus the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border. It's a place of death and desperation. We'll speak to author Ken Ellingwood about the immigration crisis. You're listening to Here and Now. In Chicago, J.J. Jameson was a likable, well-known poet, a faithful congregant at a Unitarian church. But in Boston, he was remembered by law enforcement agents as Norman Porter Jr., a double murderer who was on the lam and on the state's most wanted list. 20 years ago, after one of Porter's murder convictions was commuted by then-Governor Michael Dukakis, he escaped from a Massachusetts minimum security facility and settled in Chicago under a pseudonym. The search for Porter ended 2 days ago when Illinois State Police arrested Porter in his church. Joining us on the line with more of the story is David Borrari, a reporter for WCVB-TV in Boston. And David, first of all, tell us, what led law officials to Norman Porter?
Well, it's instructive because it tells us how other fugitive cases may fail. There were fingerprints that were made of one person under the alias J.J. Jameson, although it wasn't known that he was operating under an alias, in 1993. It would appear, it's not clear, but it would appear that the FBI misread those fingerprints. They didn't have a computerized system at the time. They had fingerprints. Now, 12 years go by, and suddenly the Massachusetts State Police and the Department of Corrections here are notified of a fingerprint match.
And I just want to stop you there, David, because we understand that they got an unsolicited form letter in the mail. You'd think there'd be maybe a phone call or something, some urgency.
The best case that can be made for this is that the system works, but certainly not quickly.
Well, now we have these. So now we have this notice being sent to Massachusetts. How did they get the fingerprints in Chicago? What happened?
He had been arrested on his third arrest while a fugitive, the third arrest that we know about. He was charged with theft. That was the first of the crimes that he was arrested for that required fingerprinting. So now police fingerprint somebody by the name of J.J. Jameson. He stayed in Chicago by that alias. Now the good work, the good detective work of the fugitive squad comes in. They start running the name Jacob Jameson under all possibilities. They strike it rich with J.J. Jameson, which all of a sudden kicks out his name on websites. He's been named Poet of the Month in Chicago. You can listen to J.J. Jameson's poetry on the web. A fascinating excerpt, Robin, is him talking about prison walls and graves, a real fascination, obsession with prison walls and graves. Now we know why. In any case, they track it down. Sure enough, they come up with J.J. Jameson in Chicago.
How is he able to get away with this, David? Is there any sense that people in Massachusetts might have known that he was there, maybe even aided him?
The fugitive squad believes, in fact, that he was assisted along the way, that he was, someone helped him escape. Someone also helped him flee the jurisdiction. Now, what you have to understand, and this is in this arrest, there's lots of concentration on those murders he committed. He, in fact, had pled guilty, was serving two life sentences for second-degree murder. But at the time, Norman Porter represented real hope for reform. He was drafted into a furlough program. An extraordinarily bright young man. He started a poets group at Norfolk Prison. He started a radio station, a newspaper. There was some sense that Norman Porter, who had gotten a terrible start in life and committed two brutal murders, had somehow turned himself around in those 20 years and was worth a chance. At the time, Norman Porter was seen as worth taking a risk on. One of his sentences was commuted. He was serving time on the second sentence. He would have been eligible for parole. Apparently, lost hope. He was in a low minimum security prison. One day, he signed himself out. People are shocked by that now, that, in fact, you could sign yourself out in that facility. He signed himself out, walked off, never returned. It's thought that he was assisted in his escape by friends in the academic community.
What's expected to happen to Norman Porter, David?
He returns, and I can assure you that he's most likely returning to life behind bars, no furloughs, no parole.
David Borrari, a reporter for WCVB Television in Boston at Dedham Superior Court in Massachusetts, where Norman Porter Jr., a.k.a. J.J. Jameson, is arraigned today. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's estimated that the U.S. Border Control makes 1 million arrests a year somewhere along the 2,000-mile border between the U.S. and Mexico. Thousands more illegal immigrants slip in undetected. Just last month, U.S. Customs officials discovered an elaborate tunnel with a cement floor and an intercom system. Officials worry that tunnels like this one could harbor terrorists smuggling explosives. But illegal crossings are largely made by Mexicans, many of whom end up in paupers' graves, much like the one in Holtville, Arizona, where 133 are buried. And yesterday, a truck driver was convicted for his role in the deaths of 19 illegal immigrants. He was transporting them across the border. They suffocated in his truck. Ken Ellingwood writes about the players in this drama along the U.S.-Mexico border, and we spoke to him when the book first came out. We asked him to elaborate on the metaphor of a water balloon. He uses it to describe the shifting immigration bubble.
Well, the idea is that by cracking down on one part of the border to stop illegal immigration, the government is doing the equivalent of stepping on a balloon, that is, forcing the bulge elsewhere in the balloon, diverting the flow of immigrants to another area.
Now, who hasn't filled up a water balloon and can picture that metaphor? What was the area that now is sort of relieved of the immigration flow, and what is the area that's now, as you put, being blindsided by it?
The area that was the focus of the government's unprecedented enforcement effort back in the mid-1990s was the area around San Diego and Tijuana. When they put into place what is called Operation Gatekeeper in 1994, illegal crossings in that area, as measured by arrests, have plummeted over the years. The result, however, of that action was to push migrants farther to the east, and we're now trying to make those crossings in areas that are much more mountainous or desert lands, much more dangerous areas, in other words, to try to make it across.
More of them are dying.
Many more of them have died of exposure and environmental problems like cold.
Well, if you could, there's so many players in this drama. Can you just tick off the number of people that we might not even think of who are involved in this story?
Well, there are a lot of people that you would really never consider. We would always think, of course, of the Border Patrol agents on one side, the migrants on the other, perhaps the smugglers who are trying to sneak them across. But in the course of traveling along the border and writing about this story and writing this book, I spent time, for example, on an Indian reservation in southern Arizona, a tribe called the Tohono O'odham Nation. Their ancestral lands span the international boundary. And for centuries, they went across back and forth on their own ancestral lands, even before there was a U.S.-Mexico border there. And for decades after there was a U.S.-Mexico border that split their land in two, they would cross through informal gaps in the cow fence without really any concern whatsoever. It was only by the late 1990s when suddenly they found themselves, as did the people in Douglas, in the crosshairs of this new immigration war on the border. They found their lands suddenly difficult to cross. Those tribal members on the Mexican side who carry full tribal membership with the U.S. tribe were getting arrested as they came north through those informal crossings that the tribe had used mm-hmm. for many, many years.
On this program, we've covered the vigilantes, for instance, who have made it their job to arrest these border crossers. But I was also just so touched by the people who went out of their way to help them.
Yeah, there were ordinary folks just out of what they call a humanitarian impulse, a Christian impulse to help the stranger, to welcome them. One group in Arizona, for example, began placing water stations in the desert in areas that were known to be corridors for crossing. In other cases, there were people who actually helped migrants by sheltering them once they made it across the border, and even helping them get past Border Patrol checkpoints to make their way north into the interior. Mm-hmm. One woman in Bisbee, Arizona, who I do not identify by name in the book to protect her, was regularly housing undocumented immigrants in her hotel, and feeding them, getting their strength back up to continue the journey. And then she and friends would put these folks in a car dressed in quote-unquote American-style clothing, and oftentimes after having given them a hairstyle, and kind of making them look like just a family taking a little trip. And they would drive past the Border Patrol checkpoints in Arizona and get them north.
Mm. You say not many people have even been to the border. I know how shocking it is to come from the east to the west and drive along and see the picture that you've got on your cover. This looks like it's outside San Diego. And when you drive down through Southern California, there are huge signs on the side of the road, big yellow signs with people running. And when I first saw that, I thought, what is that? And what is it?
There are highway signs leading north from the border on the freeway in Southern California near San Diego that show a family at full sprint running across the road, much as you might see a deer caution sign or a moose crossing in northern New England. And they put them up in the early 1990s when so many people were racing across the border on foot.
And getting hit.
It to me symbolizes both the life and death stakes of this journey that people are making, and it also tells you just how chaotic it was in the early 1990s in San Diego. But the signs are still there,
and they could be put up in the desert, but with a different, you know, kind of death there. That's the death from the elements.
Exactly.
Ken Ellingwood, author of the book Hardline: Life and Death on the U.S.-Mexico Border. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it has been an extraordinary day in the case of Terri Schiavo. A Florida judge has turned down Governor Jeb Bush's request to gain state custody of Schiavo, and also today the Supreme Court rejected an appeal from Schiavo's parents to reinsert her feeding tube. That tube was removed last Friday. Doctors said then the 41-year-old Florida woman would die within a week. There have been a lot of opinions offered in this case. We've asked for yours, and you've sent them. From Steve Bankston, he writes, I went through a similar situation with my father, who was in a coma for 2 months. He never wanted to be a vegetable, as he would have put it. I know the pain these people are going through. Why don't they have faith in God that their daughter is going to a better place? Patricia Mage of Tucson, Arizona, had this response to the editor of the Manchester Union Leader, who suggested in his editorial that removing Schiavo's feeding tube was tantamount to shooting her with a gun. How insulting, Patricia writes. My own older sister had to make this courageous decision to honor her husband's wish not to live in such a condition. While it was hard for her and her children, it was not hard for her dear husband. He was given morphine to ease any discomfort he might be able to experience. The family had no such sedative to ease their pain, only the knowledge that they were carrying out his desire not to live in that state of being. Well, Craig Bennett of Elgin, Iowa, also wrote today. He says, I'm a 39-year-old man with a terminal illness. I've been lucky thus far to never have been incapacitated. I was reared in a Christian home. I have a living will and medical advance directive that indicates I am to have no assistance to live in any way. I cannot feel or imagine the pain that the Schindler family must be feeling. But how can they insist that she continue to suffer? Their God must be calling her home. We also heard from Pete Gallo in Pennsylvania. Nobody really wants to bring up the issue of money in this debate, and it's uncomfortable to do so. But if the administration and Congress want to keep all of the brain-dead patients in hospitals alive, then they really need to raise some taxes for Medicaid and leave lawsuits open-ended. And Donna Sees also wrote to say, what about the constitutionality? Jay Barnes of New Bern, North Carolina, said, my father was in such an accident. I bless the doctor who let him go. Well, we appreciate hearing from you. Please, you can still send your letters to letters@here-now.org. We will air them over the coming days as this case unfolds. Again, that's letters@here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.